My name is Jim Hartley. I'm a president and chair of professor and chair of economics. I'd like to be president of the economics department, but I'm not. Professor and chair of economics at Mount Holyoke College. And the session that we have now is Populism and Cronyism in a Free Society. This is kind of an interesting title in a lot of ways. You know, I saw the title when they asked me to do this, and I immediately remembered back to my education. Populism was something I learned about in my high school and college history classes. And populism was that thing that Andrew Jackson was all involved in and William Jennings Bryan was all involved in. And from the way that my Marxist professors talked about it with that inner glow radiating out, I knew populism was a bad thing, like communism or the devil or the Denver Broncos. And so we have this interesting thing that suddenly about 4 years ago, I mean, almost exactly 4 years ago, suddenly populism is in the news everywhere. I mean, you can't pick up the news now and start reading about, you just read about it everywhere. It's just a constant set of discussion. And so that's interesting. You know, why is populism suddenly the thing that we're talking about, making it into a program? Cronyism has a similar thing, with the exception that it's hard to find the pro-cronyist side of things. I was really hoping one of them would say, yes, I'm a big favor. So there are people there. But it's also another term that, you know, I went through most of my life. You know, you hear about crony capitalism and you know that's a bad thing. But suddenly it also has become something that's in the news all of the time. And so we've got these two events that sort of just recent years people are talking about a lot. I can also note that there's been somewhat of a lament in the Philadelphia Society over the years that the discussions often can just be too theoretical without enough practical stuff. So it's very fortunate that immediately following our discussion of cronyism, there is, you'll notice on the schedule, a networking luncheon where you can put this all into practice. to help us think through these issues, we're very fortunate to have two people that actually have written and thought extensively on this. Veronique de Rugy is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She was formerly at the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, the Atlas Research Economic Foundation, and at the Institute for Humane Studies of Europe. She was listed in Politico Magazine's Guide to the Top 50 Thinkers back in 2015 as one of the top 50 thinkers, doers, and visionaries transforming American politics. She has written and appeared widely. Pick your favorite media outlet. She's been there. And it's just impressive resume that way. Jim Antle is the editor at the American Conservative. He was formerly at the Washington Examiner, the Daily Caller News Foundation, and the American Spectator. He's the author of Devouring Freedom, Can Big Government Ever Be Stopped? Spoiler alert, the answer is yes. He also, pick your favorite media outlet, has been there. And so what we'll do, the format today is conversational, so we won't have to set speeches, and we'll start with a question. And I think the question I'd like to start with for both of you is, what is populism? I mean, I see this term all the time now, and so we just, what are we talking about when we talk about populism? Can we even define the term? Is populism just the same as popular? Could you have an unpopular populism? Is there anything that unites populism at all?
Well, I think in practice, whoa, that's loud. Voice of God. I think in practice, we see with President Trump that you can have an unpopular populist, but he is popular with the populace that he's trying to reach. So it's an interesting phenomenon. And populism has been attached to a variety of ideologies. There are left-wing forms of it. There are right-wing forms of it. It's essentially an appeal to the idea that ordinary people, normal citizens, the average citizen in some way is being ignored and marginalized by the elites. And whether we're talking about the elites in popular culture, whether we're talking about the elites in government, whether we're talking about the elites in business. And I think that one of the reasons we're living in perhaps a populist moment right now is that a lot of people feel that way, including a lot of people who don't have a lot of other things in common politically and maybe culturally. And President Trump has tapped into a vein of people who their kid, they watch television and they listen to the news and they listen to opinion commentators on the news, and those people are expressing hostility to their values, essentially saying F you. They pay a lot of money to send their kids to college. Their kids come home and look at their parents' values and say F you. Donald Trump is the only major figure in American life that these people see standing there and saying back, no, F you. And that really resonates to a lot of people.
Finally, someone who talks my language.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Who speaks my language. I actually will say that, I mean, so I'm an economist, I'm not a political scientist, so I can't illuminate you about what populism really means in the literature, but I actually think that very often, like you, a lot of people think of populism and kind of frown, like, But there is some aspects, I mean, it's getting a bad rap because it is, as Jim has said, I mean, in one of its version, it is a system where the individual is not crushed by the elite and businesses and the government and in its worst form, the unhealthy alliance between government and big business and businesses, actually, I should say.
So, but if you think about the way we use populism now, there's the Trump populism, but the other big populist person is Bernie Sanders, right? Yeah. I mean, and so we hear about that, and so. Are they the same? Is that what I should conclude, that Trump and Sanders are the same? And in what sense are they both populists?
Well, so I'll take a shot, very uninformed shot, but I will say that unfortunately, I think one of the things that is surfacing right now is that the version of populism as expressed by politicians is one about all the things the government can do and will do in order to rectify some sort of perceived or real dysfunction. And so this is where I frown, which is kind of like they are, I think, some real concern that both of them are raising, but often the means to address them, I mean, it goes through the government. And this is not new. Remember the Occupy Wall Street? I could sympathize with these guys, like about when they were expressing this notion that there is something that's like, you know, the banks are protected and they're being bailed out and but then their solution was actually to go directly to the agent that were actually extending the protections to big corporations.
Yeah, I mean, there are some areas where I think Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have some common ground. I mean, they both disagree with a lot of the trade deals that we've concluded in the last few decades and our trade policy more generally. They both are sort of politically empowered by the sort of loss of industrial jobs, and particularly in the Rust Belt of the United States. They both had various objections to the Iraq War and the direction of U.S. foreign policy. They both have similar critiques of the American political elite. A big difference, though, is that the left-wing version of populism has a program, and they've had a program in many respects dating back to the early 20th century. It's certainly been updated and modernized to some extent to deal with things like student loan debt and things that are of more recent vintage. But what a sort of democratic socialist such as it is believes is pretty clearly established. The conservative populist program, I think, is something that's still emerging. It's something that's still coming together as conservatives grapple with global capitalism in its own right. And I think Trump may be a transitional figure or may not prove to be, but at the moment, the Trump program is mostly a fairly conventional fiscal conservatism married to higher tariffs and at least an aspiration for some form of immigration restriction. And some of these other details have not been fleshed out. So Trump is certainly not the libertarian populism, the free market populism that people were talking about in 2012, 2013. He doesn't have an inherent hostility to government working with business. He simply doesn't like the way that it's been done up to this point, and he doesn't like which businesses have benefited from it. But Trump is not animated by the idea that the new welfare queen is Goldman Sachs or Boeing or you know, some other beneficiary of corporate welfare. Trump is animated by the idea that the United States has been treated unfairly by the rest of the world and by its elites, and that this needs to be rectified in some way. And the challenge that is framed in his rhetoric has not yet met up with a policy response, I think.
But when you say fiscal conservative, you certainly don't mean on spending.
Well, but what Republican president in our lifetime has been any good at spending?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, there's always been a big disconnect on the broad right about what they stand for and what they actually do.
But in the sort of distinction that you're both making, I think, you know, you've got the population out there and then you've got the elites, and populism is this appeal to the population. Are these strains of populism appealing to the same population? In other words, are Trump and Bernie Sanders actually, there's these people out there that feel this, there's these elites up there, and Trump says, oh, I got one policy solution, and Bernie Sanders says, I got another one, and that's just the normal political debate, or are they appealing to fundamentally different parts of the population in their populism?
I mean, there is some overlap, and that certainly was helpful to Trump in the 2016 general election. There were some voters who voted for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries over Hillary Clinton who actually swung to Trump, particularly in some of the states that really mattered in terms of him winning the Electoral College. But overall, no, they're speaking to very different demographic bases. And, you know, and Bernie Sanders speaks largely to younger, white, college-educated, frequently affluent liberals and some old labor union type Democrats. And the latter group is where you do see some Trump Sanders overlap, but in the first group you see none. And Sanders has been limited by the fact that he can't, in today's Democratic Party, reach beyond a mostly white progressive base. That's generally not good enough anymore to win a Democratic presidential nomination. He's been hindered by the fact that he can't appeal to Black and Hispanic voters in large enough numbers, although he's done a little bit better this time than he did in 2016. Donald Trump very clearly appeals to a sort of middle American type of voter. And even among the Republican Electoral Coalition, he is less popular among some affluent, college-educated, traditional Republicans. And he's made up for that by the fact that he's grown the Republican vote share among non-college-educated white voters, and he really turns out rural voters. So sometimes when the suburbs are a little soft for Republicans, whether it's in a special election or something like that, and Trump comes to town to campaign, the suburbs might be soft, but he really can turn out those rural voters. So he is speaking to a different set of people, even if some of the grievances both voting blocs have are the same or at least similar.
Yeah. I think we could put Elizabeth Warren in the same camp as Sanders, of who she's talking to, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, she doesn't have sort of the emotional populist connection that Trump and Sanders have. She comes across as more of a policy wonk, and she's clearly much more animated by cultural liberalism than Bernie Sanders is, and certainly Trump. She's definitely tried to come up with a policy agenda she thinks would be a progressive response to some populist concerns.
But I think this is exactly where I get stuck in the, if populism is there's a set of voters out there that want to vote for me, and then you've got a set of voters that want to vote for you, and we're debating policy things. Was Ronald Reagan a populist? And then right after that, was Barack Obama a populist? Could we describe both of them as populists? They're out there, they find a set of voters, they build a coalition, and they get elected.
Well, I'll say that I think there is actually, there is a version of populism that that is attractive, that would be attractive if done well to a, you know, a higher income, educated class. Mm-hmm. It's about individual. If really it's about getting rid of cronyism. I think this is a sentiment, or like getting rid of the game that are being played and the special interests, the government picking winners and losers, right? I think it could actually broaden its appeal quite dramatically, and I think about it this way, when the Amazon bid for subsidies were going on. I mean, you had a strong coalition between libertarians, free market, and the AOC of the world, right? Who shared a real complaint right? Now, we don't share the way of going about addressing it, nor do we share the profound dislike of business that she expresses and that Sanders express and Warren. And I will say that I think this is one of the appeal of President Trump is like for all his flaws, I mean, the guy is genuinely, like he has nothing against businesses and he's fully supportive and he also believes America is freaking great. So I think the problem with populism as it is done is I think it's missing, it's missing a big appeal to people who you wouldn't think right now would support this agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I think every national election winner uses populist rhetoric to some extent, but that doesn't make every one of them a populist. I mean, I think Barack Obama and to a lesser extent Bill Clinton were very much defined by, we're smart people, we know how to solve these national problems, we'll take care of you, everything will be fine, just trust us, which whatever can be said for that is not a populist sentiment. It's very much the opposite of that. Obama in particular, I think, rested on a lot of confidence on elites and elite institutions to solve problems and not create and cause problems. And I think that there's a real risk for Elizabeth Warren that she could end up being viewed in that way, where it's less populist than paternalistic. So populism isn't just being popular or mobilizing a base of voters. It's seeking to defend that demographic group, that base of voters, from perceived elite hostility to them.
So, but then we have the same thing. So Ronald Reagan, then he comes in and you know he preaches to the common man and we're, you know, it's Good Morning in America, all the rhetoric of it. Right. But fundamentally, he's saying, well, this is what government should do, what it shouldn't do. It's not the same as what I think was the progressive paternalism, but it is very much a, here's what we think government should do. So one way to read that then is populism is just inherently left-wing or anti-left-wing, sort of conservatives are inherently populist, the left isn't populist, but that doesn't fit my Bernie Sanders populism at all. So there must be something more to this. Fundamentally, I guess the question I'm trying to get at is, are we all populists in the end? You know, in other words, we just talk about the term periodically, but at the end, we all believe that there's people out there, they matter, and then we're just all debating what kind of government will make those people's lives the best.
Well, I think one of the big reasons that there's such a debate on the right is that Ronald Reagan was animated by a certain view of what government should and shouldn't do, but he also had a vision for what America should look like. And, you know, it was a very small town, community-oriented focus. And I think when we've started to hear some of these debates in more recent years, you have a subset of conservatives saying, okay, well, what if the economic policy that reflects your belief in limited government does not produce or sustain or conserve that vision for what America should look like? You know, what if we're giving a tax cut to a corporation and then that corporation turns around and won't do business in my state when my state passes a pro-life law, but will do business in China even when they're persecuting religious minorities and putting people in concentration camps. But if you know they have an evangelical governor or something who says Jesus, you know, they all pull out of the state and don't want to do business there anymore. So I think that has made some conservatives question some of the fundamental principles of the fusionist bargain, which has been interpreted, I think misinterpreted, but has been interpreted to mean that libertarian means will necessarily produce traditionalist ends. And that's not really what it actually means, but I think it's been widely interpreted in that way. And if you do interpret it in that way, you really have to say, it doesn't actually look like that happens.
But, I mean, I think you're absolutely correct. But I also think that what's, at least to me, is infuriating about the backlash against the free market movement I mean, which takes the form of like a backlash against libertarians, which is really funny considering, you know, libertarians have never been in power and can't really truly feel like they're big winners ever. So it's the fact that there's no actually reflection over who is responsible for the state of the world. Like, there is, we can agree that there are things that are not working, and it's kind of fascinating that people are saying, aha, it's gotta be capitalism, it's gotta be free market, it's gotta be those libertarian, it's gotta be, when actually the government is everywhere acting, particularly active in these spheres that people point to as being areas of problems that needs to be addressed.
So if we think then populism broadly, could we use this sort of notion? Is European populism the same as American populism? Or is that a
different thing? I don't understand Europe.
Hmm?
I don't understand Europe. Ever.
Ever, yeah. So, and what about the Hong Kong protesters? Could we just call them populists? That what's going on there is people rising up in Hong Kong that...
Listen, again, so my problem is, like, I'm not a political scientist, right? So I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all I can say is that these guys are, I mean, in one way to look at what's happening in Hong Kong, and I don't know if it's correct, but is to say that if you give economic freedom to people, there's a moment where they're going to be asking for political freedom too. Maybe it's not true, but that's how it feels like. And they're like had enough, and I think, could you label this populism? I don't know. Another thing I know for a fact is that there is a version of populism that I find extremely appealing, to go back to cronyism. This notion that we have had enough of government-granted privilege being distributed to winners at the expense often of unseen victims. And I can give you a long, long list. And it may not have a gigantic budget burden, even though it's actually pretty, depending on how you define it, $100 billion a year in subsidies and things like this. It's not nothing. But it's the biggest problem is actually really the fundamental corruption of capitalism through the means of government-granted privilege. And that aspect of populism I was excited about. I was like, yay, you know, I relate to what you're saying, and I'll join the barricade with you, until after the barricade I realized was France. And I was like,
So the cronyism thing, though, I mean, a slight bit in that. What is the difference between cronyism and just lobbying the government? Are those just equivalent terms, and we now just, what we used to call lobbying, we now just call cronyism?
Yeah, in my opinion, it's actually different. I mean, like, not all form of lobbying is for the sake of actually getting a handout. However you want to define it, there are so many things that the government does to favor a particular industry, firm, or a company. But I mean, there's sometimes a lot of lobbying in order to prevent the government from interfering and destroying your industry or your company. So to me, like, cronyism is really defined in, like, as the marriage between government and the private sector. Anything the government does to favor, whether it's through loans, subsidies, barriers to entry against competitors, to favor a private company, that's cronyism. I wouldn't go as far as to say that lobbying is cronyism. Some of people lobby for crony reasons, but.
You know, obviously one of the things that is done to sort of elide the distinction between cronyism and just the normal way business is done is that you always try to find an ostensible, or in some cases very real, public benefit that is also attached to the fact that you're going to make a lot of money yourself. And in Washington in particular is a town full of people who are making a lot of money but have convinced themselves, and in some cases rightly, that, well, I'm making all this money, but I'm doing it because I'm doing these public-spirited things that are good for other people, so it's not really that bad. That's allowed, I think, a lot of cronyism to steal many bases, because I think cronyism in and of itself, if you just, when you look at the workings of government and big business together, there are very few people who would actually favor that. But when you can point to jobs in a congressional district, when you can point to some ostensible environmental benefit, when you can point to tax revenue figure, especially when you see this at the local level a lot, where and state level to some extent, where they're competing for different businesses and they're all vying to give subsidies and tax breaks and build new roads and clearly you can see where some of the localized benefits to that are, even if in aggregate taxpayers are at a disadvantage.
So would tariffs be an example of cronyism?
Yes.
They can be.
There could be some national security reason, but
right.
And that doesn't, I don't think addressing national security reason with economic policy is a good way to go, but for the most part, I'd say yes.
I mean, ultimately, when you get into protective policies, you are going to have to think of which businesses that you want to benefit from that. And I think that's going to be a challenge that conservatives in particular are going to face, is that as we enter into a globalized economy, it's not always a guarantee that the free market outcome is going to serve the national interest, but you do have the likelihood that most government interventions are going to at least have conflicts of interest and have a very high risk of unintended consequences, as much government action does. And so markets certainly allocate resources better than governments do, but markets, like governments, are made up of people and are therefore imperfect.
Well, I'll add one thing to this, which is actually this notion of national interest, I actually have never understood what it means. I don't understand what it means. I mean, unless you're talking about, broad concept of, prosperity and I just think that very often the way government defines national interest is actually fairly crony, or is the way of picking winners and losers, too. So I agree. I mean, I totally agree that in that sense that the free market doesn't necessarily give all the outcomes that people wished based on each of their different preferences or. But I'm always kind of wary of this national interest.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right that it'll frequently be exploited by people who want their own personal benefit, and there, in a lot of cases, are no perfect ways to divide the line. But there are national interests of a country, and if all of the suppliers of a technology that is important to your national security are all in China, maybe that's a market outcome, but is that a good national outcome? And I think China has really been a focal point of why you're seeing some of the new free market skepticism on the right, because the argument was made in the 90s that if China pursued economic liberalization and we liberalized our trade with China, we would essentially export our values to China, and China would find it impossible to maintain a certain level of affluence without its own people clamoring for more political freedom. So far, that hasn't happened. Maybe Hong Kong is a sign that in the fullness of time that will be true, mm-hmm. but up to this point, it hasn't happened. And when you look at the NBA and people, having their Free Hong Kong signs snatched from them at the stadium because they don't want to lose access, the team owners don't want to lose access to that market, at the moment, it looks like it's working in the opposite direction. Now, that doesn't mean that that's how it's always going to work. But I think, having, these players, LeBron James coming out and lecturing, people for speaking out on Hong Kong and saying they don't know what they're talking about, whereas any other politically correct cause would be totally fine for them to speak out on, I think that has crystallized things for a lot of people.
But I also think that very often we ask way too much of the free market, right? I mean, there's no doubt that actually what has worked in our approach to China. It's like certainly until 2012, it's like, you know, there's ups and downs. Until 2012, China definitely liberalized. To expect that it was completely transformed in one easy swoop, the population of a regime that has been communist for so long, right, is asking a lot of the free market. When you actually look at what it has delivered, however, in terms of, sure, higher import, which is very good for us, but also much higher exports, I mean, and all sorts of things. I just think it's like I agree with you that we sell too much with the notion that if we get free market, if we get towards a freer system, we're gonna get all of these things. I think people overcommit. But I think it's unfair to kind of give a bad rap to markets for all of this.
But I think where this hits the cronyism discussion is, you can imagine you have freer trade with China that benefits some subset of companies in the United States. You restrict trade with China, that benefits some subset of companies
well, actually,
in the United
States. Actually, you have freer trade with China. That actually is a populist position because it actually privileges the consumers, people. I mean, the benefits of trade, right? It's mostly for the benefits of those who import, the consumers. And so we have a way of thinking about trade, and which leads to a lot of cronyism, and I think, and a lot of it actually is embedded in the way we do multilateral trade agreements, which I support, right? But fundamentally, there's a mercantilist vision underneath those, which is we'll tolerate your imports as long as you let us export. That is not populist. That understanding of free of trade. The populist understanding of free trade is to understand, and it's completely consistent with the way economists value trade. Exports is a cost. Import is the true value of trade, and it benefits consumer. And that, in my opinion, is more populist than the notion that we're gonna subsidize Boeing to export more planes all over the place, or we're gonna put in place a ton of export subsidies.
So, I mean, but that distinction, right? You're saying, you know, the free trade benefits the consumers and the consumers are the people, but producers are also people, right? So
yeah.
So every one of those consumers is working in a firm,
and
right?
And importers are often exporters. And,
exactly.
And so this notion that it's all super separate, and I mean, half of what we import actually goes into the production of things that are produced in the U.S., right? So they're consumers and they're producers.
Right.
So it's like, it's unfortunately, because we have national accounting system, and we tend to have a rigid definition of things, but the real world is so much more messy.
Right, and so, but I think that's where I get stuck again, right? Now, I wanna be stand against cronyism. Do I stand against cronyism by saying, well, we're gonna have lots of free trade benefiting one set of people over the other? Do I stand against cronyism by having restrictions on free trade benefiting one set of people
against
the
other? But I don't see how the free trade benefits one set of person over the others. I mean, like, if you have, like, again, I come to this, again, understand, I come to this as an economist, right? There are aspects of trade that are like people look at through a completely different lens. But for hundreds of years, the way what economists have actually shown is like the true benefit of free trade is one that's fundamentally unilateral. It doesn't sell politically, and people are really opposed to this notion now, but the understanding that economists have is like, it is in the benefit of your country, talking about national interest, to lower your trade barriers independently of what other countries are doing. So, and again, who does it benefit? It benefits consumers, but it benefits consumers of final goods, but also benefits of input, consumers of input, who are themselves producers, who are manufacturers, who also are exporters. So I don't know, I just like, I have a very, I think that if you wanna not have the government pick winners and losers, which is one of the things that everyone claims they like, the best way is to actually set a system that actually doesn't design like by saying we favor you over you. And I would recommend that everyone actually goes and read the feed of Justin Amash once in a while, whatever it is you think of him, because this is the one guy who actually explains systematically why he votes for or against, and very often you actually see laid out the arguments that actually this bill is designed specifically to favor a group over another, and the unseen victims or the not so unseen victims are. But obviously politics is so different than economics that few people think this way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, where there is a fundamental disconnect between a sort of nationalist populism and an anti-cronyist position is that on some level, populists and nationalists do want to pick winners and losers, and they want to make sure the American people are the winners and never the losers. Now, that's obviously easy to say as a rhetorical ploy and harder to do as a practice of government policy, but on some level in a democracy, I know we're a constitutional republic, but you know we use democratic means of picking our people. I know some people in the audience will appreciate that distinction. In a democracy, it matters that a lot of people don't think that they're benefiting from this, particularly if they're people in your electoral coalition. You know, one of the reasons that we've consistently lost on healthcare is that you know a lot of people say, oh, I can't afford healthcare. I don't like my insurance company. I can't get. They have a variety of reasons why they don't like the healthcare status quo. And the pro-limited government response is quite frequently, what are you talking about? Your healthcare is fine. Mm-hmm. Your healthcare is totally fine. And then so, yes, during periods of time where Democratic healthcare proposals are disruptive to people's existing healthcare arrangements, that argument can be won. But over time, it's not. And so you've had growing healthcare entitlements. We've reached a point where Obamacare might actually be a conservative policy compared to things that are realistically on the forefront in American politics. So yeah, the people can be wrong in their perceptions about things. But when you have a large group of people, it's never worked very well, even when it's been done to the other side of the political aisle. When it's people on your own side of the political aisle, you do have to find a way to accommodate and address some of these concerns.
So is there a link between populism and cronyism? I mean, and I guess I'm trying to figure out, are they positively or negatively correlated here? You know, in other words, does more populism reduce cronyism, or does more populism increase cronyism?
Yes.
Both?
Yeah.
It depends. It really actually depends on what type of policy you put in place to implement your populist agenda.
Right.
If you're going to be using the government, for the most part, the government, what the government does, except when it deregulates or actually establish legislation that are actually treating everyone equally, what the government does is picking winners and losers, right? So the government can have populist agenda and policies. For instance, if they said from now on no government granted privilege ever, that's a populist agenda. But it really depends, right? And
so something like the tariff thing. So you have a set of workers that have been displaced by international trade. They're out of work. And then you have a populist agenda saying, okay, we're going to help you. And one way we're going to help you is we're going to get your jobs back. Is that cronyism or is that just populism or is it both?
It's misunderstanding of economics mm-hmm. and false promises. But it's just, so The problem is a lot of the things that economics teaches us, right, is to see the unseen, right? And politics deals at the seen level, right? And it deals at you notice that in a bunch of places, people are displaced by competition. And by the way, I find it fascinating that people care about import competition, which is not different at all with domestic competition. It has exactly asked the people who worked for Blockbuster about competition and displacement, or travel agents displaced by Expedia, or but anyway, there's a focus on this. And you think, aha, you know, trade is the problem. And we're going to do all these things, make complete false promises, because jobs are not coming back for a variety of reasons, as opposed to actually kind of ask, okay, so let's first see, there's been this burst of import. Let's look at exports, by the way, and the job that's created. Oh, there's also been a reduction in manufacturing jobs. That has happened the last 60 years, and it's, you know, and it's not novel. A vast majority is actually through labor-saving innovation, right, which makes people more productive and brings on higher wages. And by the way, let's look at the reason why, unlike in the past, where when you had an economic boom somewhere or an economic depression somewhere, there used to be economic migration intrastates, and that is not happening anymore. And why is this? And when you start thinking about this a little bit, and kind of under, instead of just blaming import competition for everything that's like, and not to mention, not to say, by the way, that it hasn't been highly distortive. I mean, the massive influx of Chinese import for all the benefits to consumers. I mean, there's no question that it has been highly distortive, and that because of the scale, the adjustments that always happen, you know, took longer to happen. But also people stay stuck where they were. And we don't ever look, most people don't look at actually all the service industry that has been created, and just kind of focus on the cost, which is visible. And so that's my problem with the issue. It's not to lament a particular state of affair and to notice it. There are a lot of things we can all agree on. Is just to go to conclusions that are just so wrong and not going to address anything. That's what we all want, things to be better, but adopting the wrong policies for the wrong reason, just for populist reason and because it sounds good, is not going to make us
much better. I do think, though, that economic conservatism, as it's tended to manifest itself in our politics, is less about economics and maximizing efficiency, and it's more maybe a secularized version of the Protestant work ethic, right? So, you know, Bill Clinton talked about having an economy where people who work hard and play by the rules, you know, will be rewarded. And as you have people who identify as conservatives who no longer feel that is true of our economy, that, you know, maybe I have an iPhone and maybe I can drive an Uber, but I don't have the kind of personally rewarding work that I once had or that my father or grandfather had, that perception is damaging to the political and social consensus that's necessary to sustain a free market economy.
I agree, and unfortunately we can't go back to show these people that they're glamorizing the past. We can't really, you want to live like in, you know, 50 years ago? I think there's a disconnect between people say they think they have lost without acknowledging all that has been gained.
Sure.
You're totally right that this is really damaging us, and we're taking a big hit because the cost are often visible. But the benefits are taken for granted.
Right. Well, and I think that's always been a problem for advocates of limited government, whether you're talking about anti-cronyism or whether you're talking about anything else, is that often the benefits are very clear-cut and go to identifiable people, and the costs are spread out, and people don't necessarily feel that they reap the benefits of repeal of some program or abolition of something.
Talking about the Export-Import Bank, which I hate with a passion, I have, but it's like it's just kind of the quintessential. But it's an illustration of, I mean, there's so many more. I pick on XM, but I could go
Bowen's
after
Bank.
Yeah. But it's very easy to say, oh, look, you know, it's created that many jobs, and it's subsidizing that many exports. And it's, of course, very hard to actually say, well, actually, let's look at who the beneficiaries are and who, abroad and here, and actually ask really the hard question. Without the Export-Import Bank, is it really correct that these exports, these sales, would not have happened? And it's hard to answer with the answer yes, but it is very hard to prove it, right? Proving a counterfactual is hard. And the reason why we actually know that the free market, you know, we've been fighting together against XM, right, it's like the last 4 years, we actually saw what a world without the Export-Import Bank was like. And, you know, private capital entered the market, exports didn't change at all. I mean, continued growing, and even when you control for the economic growth. And so it's a hard fight.
Mm-hmm. So is cronyism worse now than it has been in the past, or better now than it has been in the past? I mean, in other words, is it one of these just constants, or is it increasing or decreasing over time?
I think there have been some very specific victories over cronyism. I think at least temporarily XM was one. And I think things were trending in a somewhat positive direction in terms of people consciously politically opposing this stuff a few years ago. I do think in most respects it's getting worse. And I think that a lot of the major political programs in both parties really either are cronyist, you know, when you're talking about things like green jobs, or they can be very easily diverted in a cronyist direction. Healthcare, we're just seeing a lot of situations where, monopolization and government support and economic concentration, and this is a real threat to the free market going forward. It's not the understanding of the free market that...
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's also more visible now because it's concentrated in the hands. I don't know if it's grown. I mean, it's just when you do a back of the envelope of the cost, the budgetary cost of cronyism, which again is small compared to actually the true distortions that are the product of crony policies. It's roughly constant. Now there's a lot of, it's very subjective the way you actually say what is cronyism and what isn't. So. But it is definitely in the hands, it's systematically biased in the hands of the big player. Even farm subsidies, when you look at who is getting it, right? I mean, it's the big farms. It's like, it's those big farms that would do perfectly fine without these subsidies. And it is really done at the expense of younger farmers, because the price of land is more expensive because of these policies, and also small farms. Everywhere you look, and I am against government-granted privilege, even for small companies. I'm against. Like, I'm one of the rare person against the Small Business Administration. But it is true that it's like pretty much every single one you look, even when you look at SBA. I mean, the big guys are the ones who are benefiting. And so in that sense, I think that is getting worse.
So the last part of the title of this session was, you know, populism, cronyism in a free society. So if we take cronyism, it's not good for a free society. You're both saying that. But how big of a problem is it? I mean, is this like an existential threat to a free society, that if we don't rein in cronyism, the free society dissolves? Or is this just sort of a minor cost of living in a free society? I mean, where does it fall on the range of things we should be concerned about?
I mean, I think it's so baked into the cake. Where I see it as a potentially existential threat to a free society, I think in general it is just a cost of doing business. But where I think it's potentially an existential threat is, I think it's discrediting the view of a free society. I think it's discrediting
capitalism.
I think people now use crony capitalism and capitalism interchangeably. And that's very damaging to the prospects of capitalism. And I think it's a driver for why people are now supportive of socialism, particularly young people. And it's going to be very interesting to see if the Democrats are elected and they get in and they want to actually attack, you know, to build healthcare policies that go after the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies. The reason Obamacare passed and HillaryCare did not is that pharmaceutical companies were all on board with Obamacare, and the insurance companies got bought off because, of course, it's a law essentially mandating the purchase of their product. That's not where Democrats are today, and part of that is that that all free market healthcare arguments have kind of been tainted with a sort of whiff of cronyism. And that's just one example of how a major sector of our economy that has been so intermingled between government and the private sector could become completely government dominated.
And I think this, what Jim said at the beginning is really important. I mean, there's a budgetary cost to cronyism, and there's also all the distortion that it creates that just really devastating, because it's like it shifts capital away from towards subsidized project without any reference to the merit of the project. It actually helps a lot of it, like big banks and but the worst part of it is, first, it's fundamentally unfair, and it is a big threat. It delegitimizes the notion of capitalism. Because everyone focuses on businesses getting the handouts, getting the whatever form it takes. But what people don't realize is that, yeah, the beneficiaries, they like it. And if it's there to ask, they will ask it. But the only reason why it exists is because of the government's existence. It is the government's ability to pick winners and losers. It's the government's ability to actually distribute and protect some at the expense of other that explains that this is why cronyism exists. And unfortunately, companies are always the one blamed, and capitalism. And that, to me, is a really serious threat.
So the last question I have before we open up to the floor is this. So if you think about the recent wave of populism, however, is fine. Has that been a net good or a net harm to the idea of a free society?
I think things are not good right now, you know?
I think that the political establishment has shown that it can be successfully challenged is a net good. The jury is still out on whether the results of all of it will be a net good, mm-hmm. But I think that clearly the leadership class in both political parties has lost some of its legitimacy with its own voters, and they're expressing that by supporting people like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. And then it really depends on where those types of leaders take the country in terms of whether it's a positive for a free society or not.
So the microphone is now open. We'll repeat all the admonitions from the previous session. Excellently delivered. We should enshrine those. But we're open for questions.
Thank you. Juan Davalos is my name. I'm from Hillsdale College. It seems to me that it's very clear that economic goods are not the highest goods. Aristotle seems to establish that very clearly in the Ethics. And if that's true, it seems to me that there are instances in which a political community can make, and maybe there are exceptions, but can make decisions that will not be the highest economic decisions. For example, a country might want to establish tariffs for the purposes of national security. A country needs a steel industry in order to go to war. They can't depend on other countries for their steel in a time of war. There are problems with that right now. For example, to build the F-35, I believe we get components from 22 different countries to build an F-35. Seems to me that's going to be problematic if we're ever at war. I wanted you've been speaking in a way that makes any sort of government interference in industry, such as with tariffs, to be a negative, to be cronyism. And I wonder if you would allow that there are instances in which the government does have to interfere to protect certain industries because there are higher goods than economic goods in a political community. Thank you.
So I've said, I mean, I'm an economist, so I look at it from an economics point of view, but I am totally open to the idea that there are national security reasons for government to intervene. Steel is a terrible example. I mean, in fact, the Secretary of Defense wrote a letter saying we don't need to protect the steel industry. We're fine. I mean, and so unfortunately, I am not a national security expert, so I can only say acknowledge that there are absolutely times where national securities may prevail over economic efficiencies. You get no debate from me. Like, you know, sometimes I guess maybe going to war is a fundamental necessity. It's not good for economics. But again, steel is a terrible argument, and I think there's a pretty big literature about this notion that there's a real risk, national security risk, in actually having a lot of components coming from everywhere, because every country is exactly the same. But again, that's not my area of expertise.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes. There are times when there are higher values than economics. I think the only downside you have to acknowledge that. And I think our side has generally been hesitant to acknowledge that. But the downside of that acknowledgement is that it's then very easy for everyone to make some kind of exception to then argue that there is some sort of national security or moral imperative as to why they should derive some kind of government benefit or have some kind of government intervention on their behalf. One of the reasons it's tempting to always do economic cost benefit analysis is that that's quantifiable in a way that certain moral calculuses are not. There are higher values than economics, but economics can be reduced to numbers in a way that values cannot. So you can always count up the cost and the benefit of something economically. It's a more complicated debate when you're getting into even national security, which is somewhat more quantifiable than morality and values. But I think that there are national security implications to some market outcomes, and that the national interest has to be factored into it. But you will also see a lot of companies arguing that everything that they want to do is in the national interest.
And I'll add, you say like if a product is completely produced abroad, so that happens in some cases. What is the component for aluminum? And that has been the case for over 30 year bauxite or whatever. And there are like really good reasons why it's not done this way. And steel, I mean, let's remember on average, the domestic steel represents over 70% of the market. So it's definitely, if the case, now I'm not saying that it should be zero, but it's a bad example.
Next question.
Hi, Andrew Kloster, Scalia Law, and I guess maybe I'll ask that question in a more pointed and emphatic way. David Azarad in the last panel said what I think is the quintessence of populism, or at least a part of it, which is that economics needs to be subordinated to political processes. And I keep hearing Veronique say, I'm an economist, not a politician, I'm an economist, not a politician, and then she makes all these political statements. I think politics and economics are not separate. I've worked a lot on cost-benefit analysis. There's always some sort of model in there. There are assumptions. What counts as de minimis? What counts as a job loss or not a job loss? There's agency processes. And I think part of the populist program is recognizing that everything, when it boils down to it in a certain sense, is a transfer. And you can't really, call this a science and say that this is not a political decision. So. Repeating, what David said, and just pointing out, I think that to keep economics separate from politics is to make a political proposition which is the opposite of populism. I think they go straight to the heart of that point. I mean, and that's my question is, do either of you agree with the statement? about that David made, because I think you did, but you keep saying no, you don't.
No,
You don't reject it, but that's kind of a cop out. So I'd like a square.
I will cry really hard for America the day where that vision comes to fruition, where economics is subjugated to political power. I mean, we've seen what it's done. I'm sorry, in the USSR, Cuba, and all these places. And there's a spectrum. I actually don't even want us to become Europe, where that is in play much more. But you know. What?
But I think we already have it.
Oh yeah, no, we have it way too much. And it's a miracle I have a job still, because my performance agreement is like, my performance is judged on how much I can actually try to shrink the size of government. And I fail miserably for the 20 years I've been here.
I think you should work for the government.
I joke, like I did a performance review of me, and where I was like, when I was on vacation in France, the size of government would go down. And when I was coming back, you know, it was going up. I mean, like I joke sometimes that I'm actually really a French communist spy coming here to screw all of you up and your system.
It's nice to know we all know who to blame now for big government.
You go. You go.
Next question.
So to address the theme of populism in the free society, then, it seems to be that perhaps there's something more fundamental here, specifically with the rise of sort of Trumpian nationalism. So I guess my question is then, is the modern populist movement really just a reassertion of the American belief in self-government that has been lost when subverted by our elites and our administrative state?
Yeah, to some extent, I think that's true. I think people feel that they are no longer controlling their own destinies economically or politically. Now, the question then becomes, what do you do about that? And I think as a first step, what people are doing about that is that they're voting for candidates that all the important authority figures in American life are telling them they're not supposed to vote for. And I do think that's an important step one, but it's steps, you know, 2 through 5,000 of what those people do when they have power that really matters in terms of, do you actually reclaim self-governance, or do you just, you know, overthrow one group of cronies and put in a new one?
Yeah, I agree with this. And what I find alarming is, again, once again, I like the notion, like a lot of the ideas that are, you know, that are expressed in the populist feeling, but the way they're activated, or like where we say we're gonna defend it and implement a policy agenda, is actually through massive use of government. So if you think about it from both sides, you have on one hand, you have Kamala Harris, Senator Harris, who's talking about how in order to have equal pay between men and women, whatever that, I mean, it's just, you know, there's so much wrong just with that statement. She's going to actually demand that companies that have over a certain number of employees, you know, come and tell and justify itself to the government for every single, you know, like things that they do, how they pay their employees. And on the other hand, you have Senator Josh Hawley, who actually has exactly the same type of vision, but with big tech. It's like if you think about it, like what he's saying is like, there's a problem there. There's a difference in treatment, and the solution is you, big tech, are now going to come and report to the government and explain to us every single thing you're doing, and this is all done in the name of a populist agenda. And to be fair, that's what the government does. So demanding that the government be the agent of populist agenda, and there are things that they could do. Again, ban cronyism, no more government-granted privilege ever, no matter what form it takes. But it's the risk that we run.
Next question.
Alejandro Chafuen from the Acton Institute. You know, for me, economics is a science, but not economic forecasting or economic policy are not sciences. But the way that this discussion has been taking place almost gives reason to David Azoran. There he has been of two terms, you know, populism and cronism, and absolutely up there in the air based on anecdotes. For almost 30 years, I have been trustee of the Fraser Institute, where we have a motto is, if it matters, measure it, correct? Now, we don't have measurements of populism. You know, populism is the guy who we do not like. And the same happens with cronism. No, cronism is worse, because the only index that has been divulged, Hong Kong, comes as the most crony economy in the world. And that's the country that those of you who collaborate with Heritage or us with Fraser comes as number one in economic freedom. So we laugh at these things, you know, but the left doesn't, correct? Because there we show our great champion is a totally crony country. Now, anecdotal, the left uses private corporations and individuals working with think tanks in state universities as a great example of cronyism. No, and our side demands not transparency, the opposite. Let's keep it hidden. On our side, okay? And I think we keep it all in theory. We are never going to win. We are seen as accomplices of the evil. In the part of the world that I know the most, Latin America, the sort of Charles Koch of Mexico is called Ricardo Salinas Pliego. He's the biggest crony, no, in the Americas, tied with the biggest populist menace to the US, who is AMLO. Two weeks after he got a no-bid contract to handle $1 billion of welfare payments, he gets an award from our side. When I go to Mexico and tell my friends, are you going to speak about it? Oh no, I got this award. Oh no, he gave this grant to the university. Oh, he supported my campaign. This is today, correct? And so let me then phrase it back to the questions. You know, are any good way to measure, do you know, and this is also to the audience, because at Acton, I think it's a responsibility of us that we're going to speak about coronavirus and measure it. If not, you don't know if it's going up or down. Very happy if you don't measure it. And with populism, that's more difficult. I'm not a political scientist, but again, does anyone know how to measure it? And don't you think that to win this battle, we have to start being more courageous and naming names? What is going now, you know, sophisticated people know how to guide corruption. The United States has the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, so everything that Hunter Biden did, I bet it's legal. But this is pervasive when we have the 80% of the oil industries in hands of government. The whole banking finance thing is government. There are areas, enormous areas, that the government is there, you know, so it's a major problem.
So the difficulty in really fully measuring the cronyism, right, is that one of the easy ways to measure it, which completely underestimate its impact, is through its impact on the budget. And from that perspective, it's gone up a little bit, but again, you know, I didn't put, when we did the calculation with Ted DeHeaven, who used to be at Cato and is at Mercatus now, you know, we didn't put all of healthcare. Also, we don't measure all the cronyism that takes place through regulation. That's not expressed in that number. And it is extremely hard, and this is why it's so pervasive, and it is everywhere. There's so many, and it's hard also to measure the distortions created by it, because it's not as if there's one big program that operates in one way and then you could actually try to measure it. It's like there's so many different programs, and then there's the federal level, there's state and local government level. We do a really bad job at measuring it, because there's not one good way. And the one way that is done through the budget is really an incredible underestimation of the true damage done by cronyism. But I agree with you. I wish we could really measure it.
Next question.
Hi, Rick Nathan. I think the average American brings labor, not capital, to the marketplace. And furthermore, the average American would feel that they could compete and win against anybody on a level playing field. But the American worker has to put up with environmental regulation, taxation, a lot of minimum wage laws. And if you look at China, right, it's not just competing against people without those, it's also forced labor, right? You look at cotton, it's primarily manufactured in forced labor camps, it's slavery. And so I think the average American says, hey, look, I can compete and win, but I come to the marketplace and you are forcing me to compete against people that are slaves. Should we not then make a distinction between internal and external competition? Because one is a level playing field and one is not. And I think that's kind of this populist view of the average American saying, you know, we expect a level playing field when we bring our goods to the market.
So this is a question that a lot of non-economists ask. And I totally understand why this is a question that would ask. This is a big misunderstanding. First, I'd like to say whatever is happening in China, the violation against human rights, it's horrible, right? Nothing I will say is a defense of China on that dimension whatsoever. That said, the reason why there's this misunderstanding about why we should be scared of competing with very low labor cost countries is because we end up not trading on the same margin at all. What ends up happening is if we can offload that part of the production that has actually really high opportunity cost for us, we end up, what we've seen over and over again, is basically the capital shift towards much higher return, higher productivity areas, and higher wages. And it is proven, you know, when you look at the value of an iPhone, right, which goes back and forth many borders, many, 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 many times, the true value of the iPhone that's captured in its price, it actually comes from here, even though it's assembled in a lot of low-income places. And so there is a division of labor, and I understand why we think we're competing on the same margin, but we're not. So it's a question that we need to do a better job at explaining, and I understand why people have this anxiety over competing with low-income wages abroad, but this is not where we're competing anymore. This is not who America is. And by the way, America started becoming a service economy in 1910, and it's continued ever since. And it's, and I think it's a good development, even if it creates distortions and shocks. But these will happen, no matter what. Even if you block the borders, even if you stop trade. Like changes, I mean, not having changes would be dramatic and horrible, but those changes, they are traumatic, completely. This is why Schumpeter called it the creative destruction, right?
Greg Lawson, and it's interesting because actually, this wasn't the question I was initially gonna ask, but that there's a lag time when you have the creative destruction and the folks that are the victims of the creative destruction, how they get put into the labor force and when they can do. And I mean, part of, I think, the backlash is that the lag time between them being able to, or maybe they never do, into adjust to the new economy. How do we navigate that lag time? Because that's the political backlash point is there. So I guess that's one question. And if you'll permit me, I apologize. But another one is pure R&D. And what I mean by this is going back to things like World War II, Cold War, digital photography, internet, radar, initial satellites before they were commercialized, largely were the product of conflict and war and things like that, and the government put money into R&D, but not necessarily specific companies. Is general R&D tax money, is that cronyism, or is that, so long as it's not necessarily tailored to a specific company, which I think is obviously such, how is that looked at from the crony lens?
So I'll start quickly with that question, and then I'll go to the other one. Which was what again? I'm so old now, like I'm mad cow or something. But was the first one?
So if I were to summarize, right? So the second question is the R&D, and is that cronyism? And the first is getting back to the free trade thing.
The lag time.
The lag time. People that get hurt.
Sorry, yeah. I'm just really.
There's a lag time.
So R&D, yeah. There's a big debate. So there's some people say yes, some people say no. This is why I said, like, when we try to measure the cost. And like, for instance, especially in, like, do we count tax expenditures that it's trying to favor investment in R&D. Is this cronyism or not? There's a big debate, and sometimes I put it, sometimes I don't, and I don't have a very good answer. One of the things that you know for sure, and this is where Amash is actually kind of interesting to read, is there are actually a lot of legislation that specifically name a beneficiary to the tax cut. To the tax break, or to the subsidy, or to whatever it is the government is granting, and so there's like no, you know, there's no question in this case. But it's a good question. On the lag time, the lag time is actually something that we've experienced, and I don't think we will experience again with the China shock. It was so massive that there was actually, so there are economists who've become, who put out papers, Arthur, Dorn, and Henson, called the China shock. And what people sell their paper the wrong way, they tell us that basically what they show is like the free trade consensus, that basically free trade doesn't actually change the net number of jobs. That doesn't hold. Because what they're doing is like they're looking at these markets that were in direct competition with China import and the impact on these markets, right? So that's not what the paper shows. It shows this, but it doesn't actually measure the net job loss because it doesn't have a macro model. It doesn't actually look at export and the job created in export. It doesn't look at all the jobs created in the service industry. It doesn't look at all this. But what the paper, I think, really highlights in a really important way is these adjustment problems. That it was so massive, so fast, that it actually took a long time. And then, let's not forget, in the middle of all this was the recession, with the Great Recession. So their data is completely skewed by that fact, because it's hard to... But what's also interesting is when you look at the literature, and there's a huge literature that have followed these, actually those shocks and these adjustments, they've ended up... They happened. They happened it took a long time, but this is why I think we need to take very politically these question of competition with abroad, because of the perception that people have and then the backlash that it causes. But you're right. But the good news is, I mean, I was even reading Paul Krugman saying this in the New York Times 2 days ago, that he said, you know, that big shock, I mean, we've adjusted ever since. And we're settled at a level where it shouldn't happen again. But it is a problem. And I will say, for free market in the room, you know, we need to understand that these adjustments, one of the reasons why they weren't taking place first is the sheer volume. But there are really a lot of laws that are keeping people in distressed places. Housing, land use, regulation are devastating. Because it used to be that if you had a big shock, people used to move. Now they can't move because these big shocks happen in low income, usually areas. They can't move because the places where there are jobs, they can't live because they can't buy houses. And so it has had two effects, is to keep them out of that labor market, and to all congregate them in areas that are distressed. And this is why you observe something that we had never observed at a scale that we had never observed before. These displaced workers don't move and stay there and have no prospect. And then you have other, Scott Winship had done an excellent paper for us showing that disability insurance tends to actually explain as a causation, direct causation, for younger male not like leaving the labor force participation because they're paid for at the state and local level, high minimum wage laws, occupational licensing. They're all sorts. That is a populist agenda. Let's get rid of all that junk that actually stops people from adjusting, because that is a real concern that I share with, you know, with everyone, I mean, with most people. Sorry.
I mean, if you can't keep people working, just it's not going to be politically sustainable. Many free market policies are if tariffs and other things aren't the answer, then you have to have some other policy agenda that will put people in jobs.
Preston Knoll, Tradition, Family, and Property. So I'd like to move away from the dismal science for a moment and go back to populism. I think that we have been sold a bill of goods into thinking that the only people who voted for Donald Trump are these hillbilly rube rednecks. And my question to Mr. Antel is this. Could you please say a few words about what's called evaluation apprehension, which is basically the fear to tell someone what you really think because they're going to think you're part of the great unwashed, and how this affects our political discourse and the way the mainstream, fake news, whatever media you want to call it, deals with these issues? And how does that affect populism as we're talking about this? I mean, this, if we are the great unwashed, guess what? Some of us won't speak up. I know people won't speak up. I'm sure we all do, because they fear of losing their job.
Right. Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot to that. Look, Trump did win most of the standard Republican base, but the reason he became president and Mitt Romney did not was that he traded a certain amount of college-educated suburban voters who typically vote Republican and did vote for Mitt Romney for non-college-educated working-class voters who were living in states that actually could decide the election. They were better situated to provide an electoral college victory. And that's essentially the difference between Donald Trump being president and Mitt Romney moving to various states to find some place that will elect him to something. Definitely a huge factor in Trump's appeal is that people feel that they are not allowed to say the things that they actually think. And it isn't even necessarily the government that is preventing them from doing this. It's their HR department at work. It's everybody posting on social media. It's their friends and family members looking down on them, and that is a real factor. At the same time, it's also
peers in college.
It's clearly not gotten better under Trump. It's, if anything, it's gotten worse, just that Trump is pushing back on it himself in a way that maybe other Republicans would certainly not have. But the political climate, if anything, you at least anecdotally, and I think there is actually some data that supports it, people are less inclined to want to talk politics, even with people with whom they've been friends. You find that people now will completely disown someone because they have a different set of political views than them. That's actually kind of unusual in our recent history. This Civil War brother against brother type of mentality about whether you're going to vote for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. Where you hear about families, splitting up over it. It's a driver of Trump, but it's also something that has continued under Trump, and what the implications of that are going to be for 2020 will be really interesting. And I don't know that we really know. We know that there's a core base of about 40 to 45% of the American people who are solidly behind Trump, and there's a group of about 51% who say that they're solidly against him, but there's some slice of that 51% that is actually going to vote for him. And how big that slice is decides what's going to happen in 2020.
This happened in 2016 with the evangelical.
Right.
Because I remember talking to a lot of my friends who were definitely saying, I won't tell, but I'm going to vote for Trump. And then I was just like, I'm pretty sure there are a lot of people who are not counting in these numbers. But the question I have for you is, so this is very acute right now, but this is not the first time in American politics this happened, right?
Well, it's gotten ugly in American politics before. This is the first time, though, I think it's gotten ugly while the two major political parties are so sorted ideologically. So it used to be much, you know, bipartisan political intermarriage was fairly common. There were a lot of liberals in the Republican Party. There were a lot of conservatives in the Democratic Party. In fact, a lot of conservatives who were so conservative they would have been recognized as conservatives even if they were in the Republican Party. That's almost completely extinct. And so, yeah, it was not a pleasant political climate during Watergate, but it was also just a very different time. And it's a different time both from the perspective of going after the president, but also a different time from the perspective of how a president could survive something like Watergate. It's entirely possible in today's political and media climate, Richard Nixon could have mounted a more effective defense and stayed in office, and the Republican senators who abandoned him might have feared their own voters and not abandoned him, as may be the case in this current impeachment quandary.
Carl Zeebarth, transportation consultant. One observation that you all touched on but never came back to. The fundamental flaw is that both Trump and Sanders, and unfortunately Obama and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush shared, was the conviction that government can help you. Many of us have deep reservations on that point. The other question I guess I would have for Mr. Antle is this. Most of the discussion has been on economics, on facts, on those nasty things, facts. Nobody wants to talk about them. But in fact, people who vote primarily on emotion. Do they like someone? Do they think that he's a nice person and he's going to do a good job? Now, in that respect, both Sanders and Trump do not seem to be exactly ideal candidates. However, the populist wave, which they represent, is based on perhaps the strongest of all human emotions, envy. So would you discuss that?
Well, I think in addition to the emotional component, I think people are increasingly not only voting on the basis of, do I like this person, do I like this candidate as a person? They're voting on the basis of, do I think this candidate likes me? Do they like people like me? Do they like my identity group? And do I like the people who like this candidate? And do I want to give those people political power? Or do I want to punish them in some way by voting for someone who they're not going to like? You know, I think one of the things that people underappreciate about Trump is that if you believe that the government is not really going to do anything to help you, and if you believe that who the president is doesn't really matter very much in terms of what's going to happen to your personal fortunes. And I'm not saying that's true of all Trump voters, because I think very many Trump voters believe he is going to help them. But I also think there is a subset of Trump voters and voters for other candidates as well who think if the president is just going to be this guy who gets up and blows hot air, I would much rather have a president who blows hot air that amuses me and entertains me rather than one that annoys me and condescends to me. And so I can have Barack Obama get up and blow hot air that telling me how much superior to me that he is, or I can have Trump get up, kind of bond with me, and at least be a little bit funny. And I think I would rather have that.
I'll confirm this from somewhat of an outsider perspective. Because I have never any chance of seeing my candidate to the extent that I even have one win. But one of the things that I find remarkable and refreshing about Donald Trump is like the guy is constantly talking about how freaking awesome this country is. And that is an incredible contrast with the last 8 years and with the Democratic candidate. And I think that is it's refreshing and it's great. And I think the American people, they like that. Apparently, I mean, there some, there are voters that are just very respondent to this country is horrible, and and on your economic question, as I said, like I thought it was so incredibly striking during the Occupy Wall Street movement, which I could totally sympathize with everything that they said, or the yellow jacket in France, right? And there's like everything those guys said at the beginning, I was like, yeah, the government is freaking screwing you. And what is their demands? More government. And it is really crazy. And I remember years ago, and Ovik, I think you and I had actually talked about this, I'd read this article by Andrew Schleifer and a bunch of his co-authors, it was looking at developing countries. And one of the things they systematically found is when their lack of trust in government institutions or institutions in general, people demand more government. And I thought that was so weird. And I guess it's true everywhere.
So we are out of time, but on the note that we live in a freaking awesome country, which is a nice note to end on.
I agree.
we are now adjourned for lunch. Please join me in welcoming. So lunch is in Salon Room 3 right now, and the next session starts at 1:30 back here. I will see you all.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.